chapter 9 and your outlines to page 3. We dealt with the 8 visions and then the question about fasting, and now we come to the 2 burdens. And the first burden comprises chapters 9 through 11, which is what I'm going to try to cover this morning. And then the second burden covers chapters 12 through 14, which we'll conclude with this afternoon. Because we're going to be running into this thing for the next 2 segments of Zechariah, let me point out there are 4 categories of messianic prophecies, 4 different categories. First of all, there are those that cover only the first coming prophecy, like Isaiah chapter 53, for example. A second category, those that cover only the second coming. We'll see that later this afternoon. The third category is with the first and second coming are blended together, without implying there's a gap of time in between. We know about the gap of time from other prophecies, other passages, but we would not know it from the specific passages. We're about to see that here in Zechariah chapter 9, verses 9 and 10. Verse 9, as we'll see, deals with the first coming. Verse 10 deals with the second coming. And there's no implication within this passage as a gap of time now 2,000 years long between the first and second coming of the Messiah. You have a fourth category which deals with his whole redemptive career, which means the prophecy includes 4 elements. Number 1, something about the first coming. Secondly, some indication of a gap of time between the 2 comings. Thirdly, there is the second coming, and fourthly, something about the messianic kingdom. Psalm 110, for example, falls into this fourth category. So we'll see some of these as we move into these last chapters of Zechariah. Let me summarize what the first burden is about, and then we'll begin to work with the details. But he makes 3 basic points in these chapters of 9, 10, 11, not necessarily in the order that I'll be giving it to you. First of all, there will be Israel's rejection of the true shepherd. And because of the rejection of the true shepherd, there was a subsequent turning of Israel over to Gentile hands. Secondly, there will be eventually a judgment upon the Gentile world. Then thirdly, Israel will be empowered and strengthened to withstand the final Gentile invasion until it bought her physical and spiritual redemption by the true shepherd they once rejected. Now, Kaplan's outline, we come to the prophecy that was already fulfilled by the conquest of Alexander the Great in chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. You see the first burden mentioned, the burden of the word Jehovah upon the land of Hadrak. The Hebrew word for burden has the basic meaning of something that needs to be lifted, that needs to be carried. Something lifted, something carried has the basic meaning of oracle. The prophet that uses this form for his prophetic messages most often is the prophet Isaiah. A number of different times throughout his book, he talks about the burden, the masa, of this or that. Outside of Isaiah, it's used once by Nahum, in Nahum chapter 1, verse 1, Nahum 1:1, and also once by Habakkuk, Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 1. And now it's going to be used twice by Zechariah in chapter 9 and again in chapter 12. And then in the latter part of verse 1, in the first part of verse 2, he focuses on the land of which is now called Syria, but it was the land of Hadrak, the land of Syria, with Damascus being the capital. And so as the invasion occurs, by Alexander the Great, as it begins to move after initial conquest of the Persian Empire, it begins to turn south upon the land of Canaan and the, Israel, the land of Phoenicia. And among the cities he will take will be the city of Damascus. You have a parenthetical statement for the eyes of men of all the tribes of Israel is toward Jehovah. This is a parenthetical statement to point out, though, people might not understand what's about to happen with the conquest of Alexander the Great. They must recognize it as God who is in control, and God's providence is bringing these events about. That'll be something many Jewish people recognize when this invasion begins by Alexander the Great, who will bring to an end Persian control of the land of Israel. Then he mentions Hamath, which borders in the area of Damascus. With Hamath, you basically enter into the borders of the Promised Land. The second part of verse 2 through verse 4, he then focuses on Phoenicia, which today is Lebanon. Now, Phoenicia, Lebanon, has always been part of the Promised Land, also that part of the Promised Land the Jewish people not had to this day. It'll await the Messianic Kingdom before Israel enjoys what is now Lebanon. One of the areas that Israel never gained control and settled in is what is now Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia. He mentions the two main cities of Phoenicia, Sidon and Tyre, because they are very wise, meaning wise in their own sight. And Tyre built itself a stronghold. Initially, Tyre was situated on the coastline of what is now Lebanon, ancient Phoenicia, which made it easy to attack them. So what they did after a while is build a new stronghold, an island just off the coast of Lebanon. And they built a wall that was 150 feet thick. It was a half mile into the sea away from the coastline. Before they did that, the reason they moved it out there is because when the Assyrians were in power, Shalmaneser, the Assyrian monarch, took the city, took the city after 5 years of siege. And then Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city for 13 years. He finally took it, and that's what caused the Phoenicians to finally give up the mainland route and move into this island a half mile off the coast. And that's where they built a fortified city with these very thick walls and began to save silver and gold in abundance, a point made also in Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 1 through 5. Ezekiel 28, verses 1 through 5. The way Zechariah puts it, they heaped up silver as the dust and fine gold as the mire in the streets. So they're a very wealthy city. And because they're now out to sea, they seem to be impregnable. Yet God passes a judgment upon Tyre. God will dispossess her, smite her upon the sea, and she shall be devoured by fire. And indeed, although it took Shalmaneser 5 years of siege before he took the city, on the coastline, it took Nebuchadnezzar 13 years to get the city on the coastline. As God will show them, being out in the sea half a mile from the coast does not provide the protection they were hoping for. In the good old days, we were led by the Holy Spirit, but now we have cell phones. What Alexander did was build a moat from the coastline out to the island, a half mile out, and he only besieged the city for 7 months, much shorter than Shalmaneser's 5 years and Nebuchadnezzar's 13 years. And he finally broke through the thick walls, and in the final conflict, 8,000 citizens of the city were killed, 2,000 were crucified, and 13,000 were left into slavery. What was left was burned with fire, and Alexander fulfilled this prophecy quite literally. Then verses 5 through 7, he moves down to the Philistine country, Philistia, mentioning four of the five Philistine cities. First of all, Ashkelon. Ashkelon shall see it in fear. because she will see what Alexander did to Phoenicia and did to Tyre, and so she knows that Tyre could not stand, Ashkelon won't stand, and indeed, he took Ashkelon, Ashkelon was not inhabited for a while. As for Gaza, the judgment is Gaza will be sore pained, the king will perish. And Alexander besieged the city of Gaza for 5 months. The king at that time, called Bates, B-A-T-I-S, B-A-T-I-S, Bates, was dragged to death by a chariot. Alexander had 10,000 of the soldiers killed, the rest were enslaved. The third city is Ekron. Her expectation shall be put to shame. Her expectation is that Tyre will resist the siege. But it turns out Tyre will fall rather quickly. So it compares Ekron as a Jebusite. The Jebusites were one of the 10 different tribes of the Canaanites, and the Jebusites were those which controlled Jerusalem. And the city of Jerusalem remained Jebusite all the way till David became king. For the first 7 years of David's kingship, he was king only over Judah, was capital in the city of Hebron, but when the other tribes finally submitted to David's kingship, to avoid tribal jealousy, he took the city of Jerusalem, became the city of David by right of conquest. But until David conquered the city, it was a Jebusite city. The Jebusites were those who were conquered, then became servants, then disappeared from history. And some Jebusites were incorporated into Israel, as we see in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 6 and 7. 2 Samuel 5, verse 6 and 7. And 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 20 and 21, 1 Kings 9, 20 and 21. And Ekron will be like a Jebusite. She also be conquered, become a servant, and then disappear, which is what happened to the Philistines of Ekron. And then he mentions the fourth city, Ashdod. He simply says, a bastard race shall live there, meaning the race that will live in Ashdod after Alexander's conquest will longer be Philistine. The fulfillment of this you'll see in Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 7. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 7. Chapter 13, verse 24. Chapter 13, verse 24. And then he focuses on the Philistines in general. The pride will be cut off. Idolatry will cease. I will take away his blood out of his mouth, his abominations will be between his teeth. He shall be a remnant for our God. Meaning, for the Philistines, they will cease practicing idolatry. Those who survive and some Philistines will come to faith. He shall be as a chieftain in Judah, and the saved remnant among the Philistines will be like a clan, a Philistine clan within the nation. Now, the one city not mentioned among the Philistines in this account is the city of Gath. It's not mentioned because by this point of history, the time of Alexander, Gath was already incorporated into Israel and ceased to exist as a Philistine city. So once he conquers the territories of the Phoenicians and the Philistines, he's conquered much of the Holy Land, much of the Promised Land, but then he focuses on the Jewish territory within the land. In verse 8 we read that I will encamp about my house against the army. And what the prophecy is that Jerusalem will somehow be protected from Alexander's invasions of destruction. Exactly what we do know and exactly what happened is not always clear, but here's what a Jewish legend says, recorded in Jewish writings. Alexander marched towards Jerusalem with his generals. The high priest put on his high priestly garments and came out to greet Alexander and basically to surrender the city to him. Alexander saw the high priest. To the surprise of his generals, he suddenly fell on his knees. And later when the generals asked him, why did you do what you did? He said, before I left Macedonia for my conquests, I had a dream. In this dream, I saw a man coming out of a city with very strange garments. And a voice from heaven said, when you see this, fall on your knees and conquer no more. And when he saw this man with the high priestly garments, that's what he saw in his dream. And that's the reason he chose not to destroy the city, but accepted its surrender. We do not know the legend is true or not. What we do know is Alexander did not destroy Jerusalem. And furthermore, he did not put the city under tribute. He rendered the city as a free city, meaning under Greek sovereignty, but not having to pay tribute to the Greek empire. That much is a fact. None shall pass true or return. Alexander did not enslave Jerusalem, and non-Jerusalemites went into enslavement. But then there's a progression, the second part of verse 8, from Alexander's time to the Messianic kingdom. No oppressor shall pass through them anymore, for now I have seen with my eyes. Obviously, after Alexander, other oppressors have come. But there's a typology, an anti-typology here. Alexander did not put the city under enslavement or tribute, and the day will come when there'll be no oppressor for Jerusalem anymore. But that awaits the establishment of the Messianic kingdom, which he will deal with a bit later in his prophecy. But then under capital C, the scene changes. The coming of the king in verses 9 and 10. You have the blending of the two comings into one picture without telling us there's a gap of time in between. And verse 9 focuses on the first coming, beginning with a call to rejoice. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem, not to fear. Because now he switches from a Greek king to a Jewish king. And the reason you have to rejoice is your king is coming to you. It is your king, a Jewish king, not a foreign king, not a Greek king. He's coming to you, not against the Jews, but for the Jews. And then this future king is described in three attributes. Number one, he is just, meaning he is righteous, one of the messianic attributes in Jeremiah chapter 23, verses 5 and 6. Jeremiah 23, verses 5 and 6. Alexander died, by the way, in a drunken stupor. Secondly, he has salvation. He's big in salvation, ultimately both physical and spiritual salvation. Every Alexander went, he brought about death. Death of thousands upon thousands. Thirdly, this one is humble. He's lowly, brought low by oppression. Alexander came in the pomp of power. And furthermore, the end of verse 9, there is the manner of his coming. Riding upon an ass, even upon the colt, the foal of an ass. A foal is a small donkey not yet broken in. And while Alexander rode on a white steed, this one's coming on a humble donkey. And the fulfillment of this is recorded in some detail in Matthew chapter 21, verses 1 through 11. Matthew 21, verses 1 through 11, in the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And this one is, as the prophecy noted, Zion's king. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, Matthew 1, 1. He came on behalf of Israel in John chapter 1, verse 11, John 1, verse 11. He's characterized by righteousness in keeping with Isaiah 53, verse 11, Isaiah 53, verse 11. He was lowly or humble in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 2, Isaiah 53, verse 2, and he brought salvation. Isaiah chapter 53, verses 10 through 12, Isaiah 53, verses 10 through 12. Now the significance of the triumphal entry is not a reoffer of the kingdom, because for those of you that are set to a life of Messiah course, the kingdom offer was withdrawn in Matthew chapter 12. And he already pronounced the coming judgment of Jerusalem and the temple at the hands of Rome, so there was no reoffer of the kingdom in Matthew 21. The significance of it is to note when it happened. The date is the 10th day of the month of Nisan. And the 10th day of the month of Nisan is when the Passover lamb was to be set aside. And from the 10th day until the 14th day of the month of Nisan was to be inspected and tested to make sure it was without spot and without blemish. If it proved to be without spot and without blemish, it would then become the Passover sacrifice on the evening of the 14th day and the morning of the 15th day of Nisan. On the very same day that the little animal was set aside, on the very same day the Messiah was set aside as the Passover Lamb of God by means of this rite into Jerusalem of Zechariah 9:9. And as with the Passover Lamb, from the 10th till the 14th day was tested by four different groups of Jewish leaders, by Pharisees, by Sadducees, by scribes, and by the Herodians, all looking for some spot or some blemish, but could not find any spot or blemish. As a result, he proved himself to be the Lamb without spot, without blemish, and became the Passover sacrifice for all our sins. So verse 9 was fulfilled in Matthew 21, verses 1 through 11. Now we come to, there's no indication of a gap of time before between verses 9 and 10. We note there's a gap there from other passages, like Psalm 110, another passage like Isaiah 62, and so on. We don't know it from this passage. He immediately moves into the events of the second coming. And in verse 10, he points out all instruments of war will be removed from Israel. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim, the horse from Jerusalem, the battle bow shall be cut off. Now, this did not happen with the first coming, it will be happening with the second coming. He will speak peace unto nations. He will cause peace to come in the world. That did not happen with the first coming, it will happen with the second coming. And then he concludes with his messianic reign, his dominion shall be from sea to sea. This provides the eastern and western borders of the promised land from the eastern sea, which is the Dead Sea, and the western sea, which is the Mediterranean Sea. He then goes on to also mention the northern border from the river, which is the River Euphrates, that marks the northern border of the promised land. You expect him to also mention the southern border, the Brook of Egypt, but he does not do so. He points out he'll extend to the outermost parts of the world, the ends of the earth. And the point is that while he'll be ruling from the land of Israel, his dominion will not be limited to Israel. He ruled the whole world in a worldwide general rule. The same statement is made in Psalm 72, verse 8. Psalm 72, verse 8. The rabbis contemplated upon passages like this. There were two different rabbinic views, a minor view and a majority view. The smaller view says, we have to deal with the prophecies that speak of him riding upon a donkey, and other prophecies that say he will come in the clouds of heaven. So which way will it be? And the minority view was that it depends upon where Israel is at spiritually. If Israel is righteous, at the time of Messiah's coming, he'll come upon a cloud. If Israel is not righteous, at the time of Messiah's coming, he'll ride upon a donkey. But most rabbis were not comfortable with this either-or concerning Bible prophecy and messianic prophecy, so they came up with a different theory of there'll be two separate messiahs. And the first messiah they referred to as Mashiach ben Yosef, meaning Messiah, son of Joseph. And Messiah, son of Joseph, will be the one that will come and fulfill the suffering prophecies like Isaiah 53, will come riding upon a donkey, like here in verse 9. But he will be killed in the Gog and Magog war. Then will come the second Messiah, Mashiach ben David, Messiah, son of David. He'll be the one that will win the Gog and Magog war and raise the first Messiah back to life and establish the Messianic kingdom. The majority view in ancient times was this two Messiah view. The New Testament picture is more accurate because the Bible only speaks of one Messiah, son of David. So this is one Messiah coming two times. the first coming to fulfill the suffering passages, the second coming to fulfill the conquering passages. So the first coming, he fulfilled verse 9. The second coming, he will fulfill verse 10. The capital D in your outline, we come to redemption, salvation, restoration of Israel from chapter 9, verse 11 to chapter 10, verse 12. And point one, the redemption of Israel in chapter 9, verses 11 through 17. We have here is a full exposition and its relationship to the prophecy of verse 10. And verse 11 and 12 points out, Israel will someday be freed, and be freed based upon a specific covenant. As for you also, as for Israel, because of the blood of your covenant, this would be the Abrahamic covenant promised Jewish survival to the very end of human history. I have set free your prisoners from the pit wherein there's no water. These are empty cisterns. They're often used as prisons, the kind of hole in the ground that Joseph was thrown into to was sold to the Midianites, the kind of prison that Jeremiah was thrown into. These were simply empty cisterns that had no water. And many Jewish people in the future that will be held in these confinements will be freed from them. Before the freedom comes, however, in verse 12, there's a principle of rendering double for Israel's sins. Turn your stronghold, you prisoner of hope. In Hebrew, you prisoners of the hope, a specific hope. And this would be the messianic hope. Even though I do declare that I will render double unto you. And this is based upon the firstborn principle you see in Isaiah in Exodus chapter 4, verses 22 and 23. Exodus chapter 4, verse 22 and 23. This was viewed as God's firstborn son as a nation. Firstborn son as a nation. And the law, the firstborn son receives double. In the way God deals with Israel, will be double either for punishment or for blessing. So on one hand, Israel receives double for her sins. That point is made in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 2. Isaiah 40, verse 2, Israel receives double for her sins. Also, Jeremiah chapter 16, verse 18. Jeremiah 16, verse 18. God punishes Israel double, will punish the Gentile nations. When he punishes the Gentiles, they'll be punished this much. Israel was punished this much. Israel sees double for her sins. The same point is made here in Zechariah chapter 9, verse 12. I'll render double unto you. But furthermore, when Israel comes to faith, also mean double blessings. In Isaiah chapter 61, verse 8. Isaiah 61, verse 8. Because the firstborn son always received double the amount of the other sons in their inheritance. When the blessings come, he points out in verse 13, Israel will be empowered to withstand the Gentiles. For I have bent Judah for me, I filled the bow with Ephraim. I'll stir up your sons of Zion against your sons of Greece. I will make you as a sword of a mighty man. Now what we saw this happening initially was with the Maccabean wars against the Greek Syrians, where battle after battle, the minority army, the small army of Judah, was able to overwhelm the large army that the Greeks sent from Syria. And God empowered the people like Judah, Maccabee, and others to withstand the Greek invasions, the Syrian Greek invasions, and recaptured temple and rededicated to the use of the Lord. But in the end, it will be God himself that will defeat the Gentiles in verses 14, 15, and 16. In verse 14, we see the divine intervention. Jehovah will be seen over them. He'll hover over them like a cloud in the wilderness. Jehovah is the bowman. He's doing the battle with the enemy. He's the one that's shooting all of the arrows. Jehovah shall blow the trumpet. He'll be the one to blow the trumpet, to stir up all the sons. He shall advance with the whirlwinds of the south. And the whirlwinds of the south are the winds of the Negev. These are the hot, withering winds. Normally, the winds come from the west, which cool down the country every afternoon. But when the hot Sharav winds, or the Hamsin winds, come from the Negev in the east, it causes a withering. And God will cause the heavy heat of these winds to wither the enemy. And verse 15 describes God's defense of Israel. Jehovah will defend them, they shall devour and subdue, or make a noise through as through wine. Israel will be drunk with their blood, filled like bowls of the altar, dashed with the corners. And the defense that Israel will be able to launch is because of God's divine empowerment and God's divine providence and deliverance. But again, what will save Israel will be God himself. In verse 16, Jehovah will save them in that day as the flock of his people. They shall be as the stones of a crown lifted high over his land. And Israel's final deliverance won't come by the IDF, by the Israeli army. It'll come ultimately by God's divine intervention. That point is also made in Isaiah chapter 63, verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. The second coming occurs and Jesus himself begins to fight the enemies of the armies. He'll fight them all by himself, without help of the enemies, without help of the angels, without help of the saints. And when Israel recognizes who's delivering them, in verse 17, there'll be the praise and result deliverance. For great is his goodness, how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men flourish, new wine the virgins. And Israel finally recognize who has rescued them, the one that rode on the donkey back in verse 9. And they realize that's when they recognize the beauty of the Lord, and they'll finally receive the blessings of the Lord, and the blessings of the Messianic kingdom. Then point two, he then focuses on the salvation of Israel in chapter 10, verses 1 through 7. And in verse 1, he promises the restored blessings of rain. Now in the Mosaic law, God said, if Israel is obedient, he will give them rain and dew in their seasons. If they're disobedient, these things will be withheld. Now the system of Israeli rain is that the rains fall from mid-October till about mid-April. From mid-April to mid-October, no rain falls in the country. Doesn't mean it's really dry, because in the wee hours of the morning, the heavy dew falls upon the land. In ancient times, the vine crops like grapes were raised and grown by means of the heavy dew that will fall upon the ground in the what's called the dry season. Nowadays, they have irrigation, but in ancient times, it was the heavy dew that promoted the growth of the vine products in the summer months when there was no rain. And then with the rain season comes in three different forms. You first will have the early rains of October and November, small drizzly rains that begin to break up the dry, hot ground from the summer heat. You have the main body of rain, which receives most of its rain and water supply for the year in the months of November, December, January, and February. And then you have the latter rain, back to drizzly type rains in the months of March and April. So if the early rains come when they're supposed to, and the main body comes when it's supposed to, and when the latter rains come when they're supposed to, then the productivity of Israel is so much the greater. And in periods of divine discipline, sometimes these rains did not come when they were supposed to. As a result, the products, the produce of land was limited. Is sometimes totally dry and lack of productivity as in the days of Elijah. Each of these periods of rain has different Hebrew words, which are all used here in chapter 10, verse 1. But when the kingdom is established, never suffer these wrong times of rain again. The early rains will come as when they're supposed to, main body when supposed to, latter rain when it's supposed to. So it says, ask you of Jehovah rain in the time of the latter rains. As for heavy rain in the time of latter rain, the latter rain again is those drizzly light rains. But if they need heavy rain, simply ask for it and God will send them heavy rain, which would not necessarily fall in the period of the latter rains. And just as the time comes when rain begins to peter out for the year, suddenly they get a lot more rain because they simply asked for it. So ask for little, you'll get a lot more. Even if Jehovah makes the lightnings, and because God can make lightnings, he can provide them showers of rain, even more abundant than the normal rain season. To every one grass in the field, enough for every blade of grass on every field, so nothing dies because of a lack of water. This was a promise made if they were obedient to the Mosaic law in Leviticus chapter 26, verse 3 and 4, Leviticus 26, verse 3 and 4, Deuteronomy chapter 11, verses 13 through 15, Deuteronomy 11, 13 through 15. But they, because of a lack of faith, didn't always have it. Even mourners who have suffered years of drought in more recent times. But in the future, the kingdom established, these things won't happen again. In verse 2, they recognize the failure of idolatry and the failure of all the false prophets, for the teraphim have spoken vanity. Teraphim are those small household gods. They finally realized that these small household gods were of no use. There was failure of idolatry to protect them or to save them. Furthermore, was the failure of the false prophets. The diviners have seen a lie, they have told the false dreams, they comfort in vain. I think of the nature of false prophets to tell people what they want to hear, not what they need to hear. So they told the people what they wanted to hear, and yet what they prophesied never came to pass. See, because of these false prophecies, the result was a scattered flock. Therefore, they go like sheep, they're afflicted because there is no shepherd. I'll develop this a bit more back later in chapter 13, verses 2 through 7. Chapter 13, verses 2 through 7. And in verse 3, he also points out the failure of all of Israel's shepherds. Mine anger is kindled against the shepherds, these are Jewish leaders, and the reason is for leading the flock away. Leading the flock away. And what we see here is a common motif in the prophets. You'll find it in Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. You'll find it in the other prophets of the minor prophet section. It is the responsibility of the leaders of Israel for leading the nation astray. And Jesus makes the same point in chapter 23 of Matthew. The whole chapter is a lengthy renunciation of the scribes and Pharisees, the spiritual leaders of Israel of that day, for leading the nation astray, more specifically in that chapter, for leading the nation to reject his messianic claims. And therefore, leaders are responsible. And he'll develop this in chapter 11, verses 4 through 14, which we'll deal with this in the second hour this morning. That's the way it has been, but in the second part of verse 3 to verse 5, Israel in the future will be empowered to withstand the Gentile invasion, as they realize the falseness of the leaders. And in verse 3, they'll be empowered by God, for Jehovah has visited his flock, the house of Judah, who make them his goodly horse in the battle. And because he makes Judah his good horse, it shows he is strengthening Judah to withstand. And in verse 4, ultimately, is the Messiah, the one of chapter 9, verse 9, that will save them. And notice the different terms. From him shall come forth the cornerstone, the foundation. And again, the word stone is often used symbolically of the Messiah. We see this, for example, in Isaiah chapter 28, verse 16, among other passages. In him is the nail, more literally is the tent peg. Now, when you raise up an officer's tent, you would have the central pole, and then the tent would be spread out from that pole, but you would have a tent peg right on this pole. On this tent peg, you would hang up your most prized possessions. So after the battle is over, you come into your tent, you take off your sword, and you hang it on the tent nail. That's also you put your season tickets for the World Cup. Whatever is most important to you, that's what you would hang it on. And now there must also be the tent peg, and what is important will hang on him. Then thirdly, from him the battle bow, by which the false shepherds are going to be removed. From him, every ruler together, he'll be the final source of authority. When he becomes the final source of authority, then Israel will finally have righteous leaders and not unrighteous leaders. And in verse 5, we're told about the result of the empowerment. They shall be as mighty men, treading down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. They shall fight because Jehovah is with them. The riders and horses shall be confounded. And again, the picture is in the final invasion, before the actual second coming, the Jewish people will be empowered to withstand the enemy. Now we'll see in chapter 14, nevertheless, Jerusalem will fall, but only after Judah causes tremendous decimation in the ranks of the enemy. And ultimately, in verse 6 and 7, Israel will be saved. And verse 6 describes the rescue of Israel. I will strengthen the house of Judah. I will save the house of Joseph. That includes notice both northern and southern kingdoms. All 12 tribes will be involved. I will bring them back, for I have mercy upon them. That shall be as though I had not cast them off. I am Jehovah the God, then will hear them. So yes, God will empower the Jewish forces to withstand the enemy, cause tremendous decimation ranks to the enemy, but the final salvation won't come because of Israel's empowerment. It'll come because God himself will defeat the enemy. This empowerment, by the way, is also found in Micah chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. Micah chapter 4, verse 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. Micah 5:1 says, ultimately, Jerusalem does fall, and the judge of Israel is smitten with a rod upon his cheek, an ancient symbol of defeat and surrender. So ultimately, it'll be God's own power that will save Israel by means of the second coming of the Messiah. The result in verse 7 is, and Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, their heart shall rejoice as through wine, the children will see it and rejoice, and their heart shall be glad in Jehovah. So following the salvation of Israel, we finally have under point 3, the restoration of Israel in chapter 10, verses 8 through 12. Now verse 8 and 9 describes the regathering as a result of the final redemption. I will hiss for them. The word hiss refers to the call of a shepherd. I found what this means practically. Years ago, when I was still a student at the Hebrew University, right in the countryside, we noticed a number of Arab shepherd boys having different flocks, but the flocks were all interspersed among the others. And I wondered how, when the time comes, will they separate their own sheep from the other sheep? And towards a certain point of day, the different shepherds all made certain sounds. Each sound was different from different shepherds. Notice how the sheep really do recognize the sound of their shepherd. And so they began to separate from each other, and the sheep were able to move towards the shepherd that they, their shepherd that was making the specific sound they were comfortable with or were accustomed to. So the picture is that God will be like a shepherd. He will hiss for them with a certain sound that Jewish people recognize and bring together his sheep back into land. He says, for I have redeemed them. The regathering follows after, follows their salvation. The final restoration of Israel, the final regathering on a worldwide base toward the promised land won't happen till after Israel becomes a believing nation, after they've been redeemed, after the second coming per se. They shall increase as they have increased, there'll be increase in population. I will sow among the peoples. And notice also, once Israel is brought back into land, then God will also begin sowing his people among the Gentiles. And so Jewish people from the land will go out among the Gentiles to win them to the Lord. As Gentiles are born, will need to be evangelized. Also, they will be instructed by Jewish believers as they travel around the world. They shall remember me in far countries among the Gentiles, they will be remembered. And they shall live with their children and shall return to Israel. So after a period of traveling and evangelizing and teaching the Gentiles, they'll be come back to land, while other Jewish people will be sent out again to continue that same work. In verse 10-11, the regathering from among the Gentiles. The regathering in verse 10 comes from two main localities. Notice the land of Egypt and Assyria. We mentioned previously the majority of the Jews who have to flee the land at the midpoint of the tribulation, most of those who flee will end up in the city of Bozra or Petra, what is now southern Jordan, ancient Edom. But two other localities where Jews will flee to primarily will be Egypt and Assyria. And therefore, in the final regathering, he'll gather Jews from Egypt and gather Jews from Assyria, which is now northern Iraq. And also, there'll be Jews in the land of Gilead, which is northern Jordan and Lebanon. As we brought back into all of the borders of the Promised Land, and the Promised Land for the first time will be totally settled by the Jewish population. It's also a time that we'll have the judgment of the Gentiles in verse 11. They'll pass through the Sea of Affliction, the Red Sea. All the desolations shall dry up. The pride of Assyria shall be brought down. The scepter of Egypt shall depart. The same point is made in Isaiah chapter 11, verses 15 and 16. Isaiah 11, verses 15 and 16. The rivers of Egypt will be drying up to make it easier for the Jews to cross over, to go back to the final regathering, the final restoration. It mentions the scepter of Egypt shall depart, meaning a lack of kingdom rule. Well, we know from Ezekiel chapter 29, Ezekiel chapter 29, we learn this, that because Egypt is the first anti-Semitic nation, the first nation to have genocide in Exodus chapter 1 and 2, Exodus chapter 1 and 2, God's a special judgment for Egypt. Now Egypt will undergo a national salvation according to Isaiah chapter 19. Isaiah chapter 19, the Egyptians will come to know the Lord. But the long history of anti-Semitism could not be dismissed because of the Abrahamic covenant. So what the prophet points out is for the first 40 years of the Messianic kingdom, the Egyptians will be dispersed throughout the world, living outside the land of Egypt. And Egypt itself will be desolate with no inhabitants. But after 40 years of worldwide dispersion, the Egyptians will be regathered back in the land of Egypt. For the remaining 960 years of the kingdom, there will be a saved nation called Egypt in the Messianic kingdom. As we'll see in chapter 14 of Zechariah, they also send out a delegation for Jerusalem every year to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. But for Israel, in verse 12, there'll be a spiritual restoration. I will strengthen them in Jehovah. They shall walk up and down in his name, says Jehovah. And Israel will be a saved nation that will continue with their loyalty to God for the whole thousand-year kingdom. However, before all of these events could occur, something else must happen first, which is the events of chapter 11 concerning the issue of the true and false shepherd. And we'll take our break at this point, and then we will pick up that section in the next hour.